It's John Fugelsang for the Stephanie Miller Show, coming to you from Talk Radio Day at the United Nations, and we are pleased to be joined by Director of Communications for the UN Development Program, Stéphane Dujarric. Thank you very much for joining us. I got to say, I didn't expect to see someone of your eminence walking around in a polo shirt and khakis at the UN. You're much more casual today than anybody else I've seen here.
Well, you're the first person who's called me my eminence, but we're under orders by the Secretary General to enforce what he calls cool UN. So we may be somewhat kind of diplo geeks, but the temperature in the building is not too cold to save energy. Mm-hmm. And so he allows us not to wear ties, except for when we're meeting foreign eminences.
Is that something new? Seriously?
It's something he started about 2 years ago. And, you know, it's kind of putting your money where your mouth is. And, you know, we have a very big complex here. And I think it's if you can save a lot of money by lowering upping the temperature a couple of degrees and let people go without ties. It's okay.
Wow. Yeah. And what's been the reaction of the world community to men in the UN without ties?
Well, as long as it's men with the UN, just, you know, as long as we stop at the ties, I think the reaction has been fairly positive. Though I would say the visiting foreign dignitaries, the world leaders that we have now, there's a very serious, in fact, meeting on HIV/AIDS. But I think you will still see them either in their shirt and ties if they're Western, or a lot of them are smart and wear their kind of national dress. And so you have a lot of Asian and African leaders who seem to be wearing very comfortable clothing.
That's terrific. Yeah. I got to say, with a name like Ban Ki-moon, you've already achieved a level of coolness that most organizations can't go for.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
This is even better.
Yeah, yeah.
I do want to say, it's amazing to me how every Secretary General always has a cool name. You know, Javier Perez de Cuellar, Kofi Annan. I mean, you don't have a lot of Joe Moskowitz, you know.
No, I think, you know, there's probably a little Joe Moskowitz somewhere in America who can hope to be Secretary General one day. It'll happen.
What do you think are the odds of ever seeing an American Secretary General?
Well, I think, you know, seriously, I think it will be very unlikely that a Secretary General will be from one of the five permanent members of the Security Council, mm-hmm. you know, French, American, Russian, Chinese, or British, because those five countries have veto power, and that's already a lot of power within the UN, and I think it would be unprecedented if there were a Secretary General from one of those countries. That being said, there are very few written rules of the UN, except for the UN Charter, so nowhere does it say that a Secretary General cannot come from one of those countries.
But it does seem to promote balance, you wouldn't want a Secretary General from one of those five veto power nations.
No, exactly. I mean, I think there's, you know, it's the UN is a balancing game between the members of the Security Council, between the Security Council and the General Assembly, where 192 members are represented, where they all have an equal vote, and the Security Council, which is 15 members, five of those always on the Council with veto power, and 10 of them are elected for every 2 years. So there is always a kind of tug of war between those two legislative bodies.
Well, I have a million questions to ask you, but I do want to touch upon the Summit on AIDS. Mm-hmm. We're now experiencing the 30th anniversary of AIDS, and the UN, to many, has been a real hero at the forefront of mm-hmm. fighting this global pandemic. And I wanted to ask you, what is the Summit on AIDS dealing with, and what are the new challenges facing the UN and the world in general, and what do you consider to be the major issue around this 30th anniversary of HIV?
Well, I think, you know, this is anniversaries are always bittersweet when you're dealing with the issue like AIDS. But as the Secretary General said, I think within the next decade, we can really make the progress that we need to almost eradicate the disease. We have seen the levels of infections drop off in a lot of places. There's been much greater access to drugs in developing countries. We can still do more on that front. The big issue now is how AIDS impacts women and children. But I think the overriding issue that we really need to get over is the stigma.
Of course.
The stigma of AIDS. And I think in a lot of countries we've gone over it, but in a lot of other countries we haven't. And
is this a first world dynamic we're talking about?
I think it's both. I think the first world dynamic stigma of AIDS is negative. It's a stigma you see in our societies. But when you're talking about some developing countries, it's really a life or death issue where someone who has AIDS can be banished from the family, can be banished from their community, and you're already dealing with countries that really don't have a social safety net. You know, as horrible as it seems, you know, in America, if someone is banished from their families, there are places they can turn to. Right. I mean, there's social services they can turn to. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of developing countries, there isn't. And people are really left alone. And that stigma is something that we all need to work on.
So how can the UN play a role in helping these people who have no safety net in a developing society?
I think the role of the UN is to push governments to enact laws that protect people who are living with HIV/AIDS. And the role of the UN is also to advocate on behalf of the victims. We often say that the UN gives voice to the voiceless. And I think when you have a Secretary General like Ban Ki-moon who travels around the world and talks about the stigma of AIDS in places where their own leaders don't even want to mention the name, I think that sends a very powerful signal. But it is a long-term project. These things, I mean, you know, cultural views don't change overnight. And we just need to keep working at it and keep working at it. And we've already made a lot of progress, but I think still a lot more needs to be done.
When one looks at the American attitude towards people living with HIV and AIDS, it's astonishing to see how far we've come in a 25-year period. At the same time, it took 25 long years to get Americans to become more humane.
Exactly.
And it took, in many cases, celebrities and athletes being infected with the virus before Americans realized, I know someone who suffers from this.
And, you know, we at the UN use a lot of goodwill ambassadors, celebrities, a lot of athletes. Where I worked at the UN Development Program, we had some of the world's top football players like Zinedine Zidane, DJ Drogba, people who may not be so familiar in the U.S. but are big names overseas. And when you have people like that go and travel abroad and give that message, athletes, you're right, have a uncommon bond with people who really otherwise would not pay attention to these issues. Mm-hmm. You know, when these guys talk, these women and these men talk, people actually do listen.
Well, and one of the
and they can lead by example.
One of the critiques that we often hear leveled at celebrities like Bono or at movements like the Live 8 concerts is anything actually changing? Does the influence of celebrities really help save lives in any way?
I think it does, but I think it's also it's a learning process. When you move from the Bob Geldof projects in the in the early 80s, I think already the
85.
Right, to what's going on now, I think we're always learning how best to spend the money, how best to mobilize people. You also have to think now that the digital revolution can have a great impact. And you know, we think of Facebook and Twitter in this country, but if you look at the figures of mobile phone penetration in developing countries in Africa and Asia, one of the biggest users of Twitter is, in fact, is Indonesia. And we can now use those networks. Celebrities can be used to mobilize their networks and their followers for real action. But we're always learning. I think none of us really have the ultimate solution. But I think all of us here really want to do good. And you want to do good and do no harm at the same time.
Of course.
But it's a constant learning process.
I spent some time last year at Sean Penn's camp in Haiti, and I'm constantly impressed by the fact that celebrity may be the most useless thing humans have ever created. But when you see what celebrity can do with the right organization, and the UN has a long history of that, from Audrey Hepburn to today.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you're in the Danny Kaye building here at UNICEF because he was one of the first goodwill ambassadors. And I think, you know, if celebrities can do one thing, it's just focus attention on a problem, I think that's already a huge thing.
You previously were the chief spokesman for former Secretary General Kofi Annan. Do you think that he's really an unsung hero in the fight against AIDS?
Completely. I was. I had the privilege of working for him, and there was one of the highlights of my career with him is in 2001 or 2002, we were traveling to Africa, and then we ended the trip in Europe. And we were in Amsterdam, and we had a meeting in a nondescript conference room in the Hilton in Amsterdam. And he had called together all the CEOs of the big pharmaceutical companies that were producing HIV AIDS-related drugs. And this was a time when these pharmaceuticals were really, people were pointing the finger at them as doing real evil by keeping drugs away from the developing world, you know, hogging their patents, hiking up the prices. And he brought them together without any fanfare. It was a real secret meeting. And he said to them, "You have a problem. And we're here to help you. We understand.
Public image problem.
It's a public image problem, exactly. And we're here to help you. But what we understand is that what you need to understand, we don't want to take your patents away. But there are solutions that we can find of you keeping your intellectual property rights. But you need to help us and we need to figure out distribution networks that protects you from, you know, protects your products from being resold on the black market. But you need to help us and lower the prices. And this was the beginning of an important conversation. And now you have a situation where a lot of these drug makers are giving away, you know, or selling their drugs at much lower prices. But it was a real example on how the UN can bring the private sector and the public and NGOs and, exactly, you know, civil society together. Because you had these NGOs and these civil society groups, you know, picketing outside of Pfizer, to name one, which is around the corner, and they weren't able to talk to each other. You know, everybody, the pharmaceuticals had a big PR problem. They really didn't know how to approach the NGOs. The NGOs didn't really want to get into a dialogue with the big evil pharmaceutical companies.
A black and white issue where nothing was getting done.
Right, and Kofi really reached out to them, but in a very discreet manner. I mean, there were no cameras. There was no, you know, we had a small press release afterwards, and that was really the turning point. And for me to have been in that room was really an immense privilege and something I still remember today.
Well, something I really want to ask you about, President, I'll try and be as diplomatic as possible. President Bush gets a lot of credit for tripling AIDS funding to Africa, but I don't think Kofi Annan gets a lot of credit for getting President Bush to triple AIDS funding to Africa. Would that be a fair statement?
You know, President Bush, I think, has a history with the UN. To put it diplomatically.
We'll get to Mr. Bolton in a minute.
Exactly. But I think the president does deserve credit for doing what he did. I think Kofi Annan and others had influence with him, but I don't want to take away the credit from President Bush for really pushing that through within a political context that wasn't really always open to it in Washington. And I really do think he deserves that credit, and probably most of that credit alone. One of the brilliant moves I think that Kofi made was to create a non-UN entity, the Global AIDS Fund, to be the recipient of a lot of that money, because a lot of people in Congress did not want to give to the UN at that time.
At that time.
Yes, I was there. So I think by creating kind of a non-UN entity, it allowed a lot of countries to give in money, and now the global fund is a terrific success.
Is it true that AIDS funding is down for the first time in many years?
I think it's not where it should be. And I think there are a lot of competing priorities. We all understand that, but we really are. You know, we have a vision where we could go, and AIDS could almost, you know, go to the history, you know, to the dustbin.
You were born in France. You've lived in the States for a long time. You went to Georgetown. How does it feel for you when you confront American attitudes towards the UN? There's a very anti-UN streak in this country. I consider it to be very uninformed populace. But how does the UN counter the ignorance and the unfair stereotypes about it that are pushed forth by certain elements, Fox News, of the American media?
Well, I think, you know, it's not so much ignorance as misinformation. And I think one of the ways we go about it is to attend events like today, where, you know, there are about 20 talk radio hosts here at the UN and an ability to speak directly to the American public. I think, and we engage with Fox News all the time. I spend a lot of my time engaging with them and try to give them the facts.
Are they receptive entities?
Yes, they are. I think there are a lot of great journalists at Fox News. I have a lot of good friends who work there. And frankly, I think I would never want to see a world where all the media outlets agree on a political line.
Absolutely.
And I think Fox News deserves credit, and you may be surprised what I'm about to say, for keeping the UN on its toes. Because I think there is not enough coverage about how the UN actually works. There's a lot of coverage about the politics that goes on in the UN, the diplomacy. But there's a lot of money that flows through the UN, and 99% of it flows through great. But like any other governmental organization, we need the press to keep us on our toes. There's a lot of coverage in Washington about the budgetary process. There's not enough coverage in the UN about our budgetary process.
Exactly.
Well, because I think people would then understand that, you know, the amounts of money that, you know, the importance of the amount of money that goes through. But sorry to cut you off. One thing I'll add, which may be surprising also to your U.S. audience, is that the UN has a bad image in the U.S., but the UN has sometimes a very bad image in other parts of the world for the complete polar opposite reasons.
Sometimes I think the UN is perceived, and I'm caricaturizing here, in the U.S. as being an organization that is hell-bent against the U.S., against Israel, and is controlled by, you know, third world despots.
Yes, and the all-powerful Palestinian lobby.
Exactly.
Yes.
In other parts of the world, the UN, the United Nations, is perceived as being in the hands of the U.S., of the big powers, and that the people in the developing world don't have a voice.
Right.
You know, when I was working for Kofi Annan during the run-up to the Iraq War and afterwards, he was being criticized in this country for standing up and defending the charter of the UN. He wasn't against the military action. He was speaking on principle, defending the charter. He was being severely criticized right after the start of the war in Europe and other parts for not doing enough to stop the war.
Well, since you've opened that door, I would like to ask you something, because there has been, not a huge controversy, but there have been many people who've claimed that there was an unofficial quid pro quo, that the Iraq war was allowed to proceed in exchange for the tripling of AIDS funding to Africa, and that there may have been some sort of agreement that allowed those things to happen. Is that and whether or not that's complete rubbish, is that the sort of negotiation that the Secretary General must always walk, that must always be open to, like, you know, bringing parties together and making compromises to make good happen?
Yes, that's complete rubbish.
Thank you.
But
it sounded a bit conspiratorial.
Exactly. I think you also have to understand the role of the Secretary General is to convene and help the parties reach an agreement. He is not the one negotiating between the U.S. and the French and the Russians on the other side about the war. I mean, that's the member states are very jealous of their independence, and they see the Secretary General. I mean, if you look at the charter of the UN, the Secretary General is described as chief administrative officer of the UN. And when the member states elect a Secretary General, they always say they'd rather have someone who's more of a secretary than a general. But it always turns out that he becomes more of a general than a secretary. So that process involves the It involves the member states, and the Secretary General is there to facilitate. So he's not involved directly in that process, which is really the purview of the member states. That being said, while the preparations for the war, you know, the military preparations were going on, there were discussions between the UN and the U.S. About what would happen, what would be the humanitarian fallout. So there were discussions with the refugee agency and World Food Program. It's like, okay, we will, if we do go to war, there will likely be a humanitarian impact, and we will need to, the UN will need to be there to help us. And so we engaged in those discussions with them, because our role is really to help the people. I mean, we're not going to say, well, you know, we're not going to talk to you because we don't agree with what you're about to do.
Right.
We need to think about the hundreds of thousands of refugees and the children that will need help.
So what are your hopes for the next 10 years in the UN?
You know, my hope is that we try to take the politics out of global problems. I mean, when you look at HIV/AIDS, I mean, great photo exhibit behind you. When you look at climate change, when you look at the spread of diseases, so much about what goes on in the UN, in the legislative process of the UN, is seen through a political lens. Not unlike what happens in your own U.S. Congress,
of course,
where there are real serious issues, but there is that kind of political lens everything goes through, and it's very... It poisons it in a sense. So that would be my hope.
Does everybody around here really miss John Bolton?
You know, John Bolton, I think, was good for the UN in a way that he attracted a lot of attention, and there was a lot more coverage about what was from journalists of what was going on in the UN when he was there. But
was a lot of his anti-UN talk just to please a fan base. Was he more accommodating and cooperative than he appeared?
You know, I still work for the United Nations, so I don't think I want to answer that question. but I think you now have a terrific ambassador for the United States in Susan Rice, someone who
who cares deeply about the issues, someone who has seen a lot of these things firsthand, who's got a great experience. And I think even though you don't see her quoted as often as some of her predecessors, she is really a terrific advocate for the United States and for a lot of the global issues we face here.
I have one last question, sir. How can regular Americans who'd like to learn more about the UN or about a foreign service in general get that information?
Start with UN.org. Go to our website. You can find out what happened, what goes on at the UN, the whole UN system does. There's also a page for employment. There are a lot of jobs that go on at the UN, and also I would encourage people to look at the UNICEF website, the UNHCR, which is the UNHCR.org, which is the High Commissioner for Refugees. A lot of jobs, and I think the UN is always looking for energetic, idealistic, and pragmatic young people to join its ranks.
Well, Stéphane Dujarric is the Director of Communications for the UN Development Program. I thank you very much for your generous time, and I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future, especially with the summit on HIV/AIDS.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Take care. We're good?
Is that good?
Yeah, perfect.
We covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was great fun. No, listen, it's fine.